Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. On a sun-drenched September day in 1962, as tens of thousands sweltered in the late summer Texas heat at Rice University's football stadium in Houston, President John F. Kennedy delivered a line that defined his presidency.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
And hard it was, and costly. Billions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of people to achieve Kennedy's ambitious aspiration of putting a human being on the moon and returning safely before 1970, beating the Soviets to the lunar surface in the midst of the Cold War. Now, more than a half century after fulfilling Kennedy's impressive goal, Vice President Mike Pence last week laid out the 45th president's own bold agenda.
It is the stated policy of this administration and the United States of America to return American astronauts to the moon within the next 5 years.
Well, this hour on Point, a fresh look at one of humankind's most audacious efforts and whether a 21st century moonshot is worth aiming for. And you can join us. What do you remember about the 1960s space race between the United States and the Soviet? Do you remember the awe, the excitement? Or did you question whether or not this was the best use of American ingenuity and money? And should we go back to the moon, as Vice President Pence suggests, or look beyond the moon to Mars? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me from New York today is historian Douglas Brinkley. He's a professor of history at Rice University in Houston, Texas, home, of course, of NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. And Professor Brinkley has just written a new book out today titled American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race. Douglas Brinkley, welcome back to On Point.
Well, thank you. It's great being here.
It's great to have you. Now, listen, the first question I want to ask you is, the Apollo 11 moon landing on July 20th, 1969 is arguably the most famous effort that NASA ever put forward. It's one of the best known. And I feel like it's been so public over the 50 years that, you know, what is left new to learn about it? So what inspired you to take this fresh look at the efforts to get a person on the moon?
Well, I'll tell you one thing new that people don't realize is that the American flag on the moon, while in the exact place that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin left it, it has been bleached white. The ultraviolet rays it's no longer the red and blue stripes have faded away if we went back there and treated it as like an archaeological dig site. The big thing about the 50th anniversary is the moonshot is really, I think, the defining feat of the American century, the 20th century. In many ways, we did big things in the 20th century. The Panama Canal under Theodore Roosevelt during World War II. You know, Franklin Roosevelt did the Grand Coulee Dam and the TVA, all those WPA bridges and tunnels and tree conservation. And then Eisenhower built the Interstate Highway System and the St. Lawrence Seaway. So Kennedy adopted the idea of going to the moon as spurring a technological revolution in America. Much of what the new frontier, what Kennedy's agenda was building technology corridors, pushing computer science at universities. The idea was that if you invested in rocketry and satellites, you would get all sorts of new spinoffs. And we have things like GPS or anti-icing on your car or airplane, CAT scans, MRI. It cost $25 billion to go to the moon. That's $185 billion in today's terms. Mm-hmm. But it's paid off in the fact that Americans are proud of it. It lifted the American spirit. But just in the marvels that engineering and science developed in order to go to the moon.
Yeah. Well, I want to play a moment from one of President Kennedy's speeches. This is from 1961. the year before that famous Rice University speech. Because on May 25th, 1961, the president stood before a joint session of Congress and proposed an ambitious goal.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish.
President John F. Kennedy on May 25th, 1961, there speaking before a joint session of Congress. And Douglas Brinkley, we should note that this was only, he gave this speech to Congress only 3 weeks after Alan Shepard did his suborbital Mercury flight. So what was it? It's just such a short period of time between one of our America's first sort of projections into space and Kennedy saying, now let's go to the moon. Why did he say that?
Well, Meghna, it's important you mention Alan Shepard because John F. Kennedy ran in 1960 against Richard Nixon and was saying that Eisenhower and Nixon it was vice president, they were losing the space race. There was a missile gap. Kennedy hammered Nixon on this. In fact, in one of the famous debate moments, Kennedy says to Nixon, you saw Khrushchev and you said that America's number one in kitchen appliances. Well, I'll take my TV in black and white. I want to be number one in rocket thrust. And he also, in a debate, said, if we elect Nixon, you're going to have a Soviet flag on the moon. I want an American flag on the moon. But once he was inaugurated, he wasn't sure about manned space, meaning putting an astronaut in space because it hadn't been done. But suddenly Yuri Gagarin and the Soviet Union put the first human into space, and it was on Kennedy's watch. Kennedy also had the Bay of Pigs disaster in Cuba. And so he greenlit Alan Shepard on May 5th, 1961. But Kennedy kept a distance from it because it could have been a disaster. We now know that Freedom 7 was a success. Alan Shepard's capsules on display at the Kennedy Library in Boston. But nobody knew it at the time. But once Alan Shepard landed safely, splashed down, he became a ultra hero, television viewers watching, and Kennedy realized space is popular, and that he had asked internally at NASA and people like Rocketeer Wernher von Braun in Huntsville, Alabama, how do we beat the Soviets? And the answer became leapfrog, go big. Just don't go one astronaut to cosmonaut. Let's plan something audacious. And that was the moonshot.
Yeah.
And Kennedy gave that speech to Congress, and the whole country funded it.
Well, so you mentioned how he was thinking about this during the presidential campaign. So here he is, then Senator John F. Kennedy, September 1960, in a campaign speech about the missile gap, using that, as you were saying, Douglas Brinkley, as a metaphor for the fact that American technology had fallen behind the Soviets. And you'll hear Kennedy even include a reference that's a slight jab at then Vice President Richard Nixon and his famous dog.
The first vehicle in outer space was called Sputnik, not Vanguard. The first country to place its national emblem on the moon was the Soviet Union, not the United States. The first canine passengers to outer space who safely returned were named Strelka and Belka, not Rover or Fido or even Checkers.
Checkers getting name-checked there by then-Senator John F. Kennedy in 1960, in September of 1960. Douglas Brinkley, though, so clearly there was a space race. There was a technology race. We were in the midst of the Cold War. But did we know for sure, did Americans know for sure that the Soviets wanted to put a man on the moon?
Well, we now know for sure they did. Khrushchev once famously told his son, you know, we can't do joint collaboration with America. Well, there was talk about U.S.-Soviet going together because if we share, the United States will learn our big secret, that we're really not that far ahead. Meaning the Soviets kept things in a cloak of secrecy. While we were putting on television Alan Shepard and John Glenn and Gus Grissom, for millions of people to watch. The Soviets did their space launches in secret and then reported the results. I think it was a big boon for our democracy that we're a free society and put those on. But, you know, it just became this idea that that there really truly was a race. By 1967 and 8, we now know that they were at the right at the time we were going, they were aiming to go to the moon. In fact, the Soviets wanted to put tortoises on the moon ahead of us. But, you know, there were doubters. There's some people that thought this was a stunt. Former President Dwight Eisenhower said, "Jack Kennedy is doing a crazy stunt." Kennedy's own father, Joe Kennedy, when he heard that speech he played to Congress, called the White House, got the Kennedy's assistant and said, "I knew Jack would do something dumb and crazy like this. You know, why is he putting all of America prestige on the moon?" Barry Goldwater did not like the idea of a moonshot. He thought the money should go to the Air Force. And many people, the NAACP, some people in the, you know, like Ralph Abernathy, thought that the money should be spent for domestic policy. So it wasn't unanimous. But Kennedy was a marvelous salesperson. And when you play that Rice speech at the opening of my interview, that's one of the great presidential addresses, period. Never has a president talked about science and technology and adventure and exploration as part of what the American dream is all about. And he did it in such an incredible way that it still brings chills to people. It's a evergreen presidential speech. And without Kennedy's leadership in this regard, I'm not sure that we would have been able to go. And even his death of Jack Kennedy became a martyred syndrome. Let's fulfill Kennedy's dream to the moon.
Well, when we come back from a quick break, we're going to explore what continuously drove Kennedy to provide that leadership, especially because, Douglas Brinkley, as you're saying, there was a great deal of contemporaneous pushback on him. It was the 1960s. All those concerns you laid out were absolutely legitimate in the midst of the Civil Rights Movement, the Cold War, etc. And the risk of failure, we should remind ourselves, of a moonshot was enormous. So why did Kennedy keep pushing on that? We'll explore that when we come back. Douglas Brinkley joins us this hour. He's author of American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy, and The Great Space Race. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Douglas Brinkley. He's a presidential historian and professor of history at Rice University. He's author of the new book, American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And Douglas Brinkley, before the break, you talked about how President Kennedy's Rice University speech in 1962 is one of the great presidential speeches of all time. We've got a little more of Kennedy calling for the moonshot here, so let's listen.
And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
President John F. Kennedy on September 12, 1962. Now, Douglas Brinkley, look, we could spend the whole hour talking about the nuances and the details of President Kennedy's speech, but there's something that you do in the book which I think deserves a great deal of attention. And you talk about some of the specific people surrounding Kennedy who were instrumental in the moonshot. James Webb is one of them, and we'll discuss him in a minute. But I wanted to ask you and explore with you the role of German engineers in Wernher von Braun specifically, because it's a complex and darker side to the American moonshot that we don't often discuss. So tell us about von Braun and his significance to getting Americans on the moon.
Well, von Braun's the indispensable person in many ways. He built the Saturn V rocket that took us to the moon, and he was a Nazi in World War II. He's a German. He was a rocket genius. I don't use the word genius lightly. He was recruited by the German military to start perfecting missiles. In the United States, we put a lot of money into the Manhattan Project for atomic weapons. But Hitler started getting into the missile program, and von Braun was able, during World War II, to put the first rocket into space. He was able to go above 62 miles and break Earth's gravity. And he then developed the V-2, mm-hmm. And the V-2 rocket was going to be the super weapon that Hitler thought would win the war. They mass-produced V-2s using slave laborers, particularly at Dora, which was a subcamp of Buchenwald. These were Jewish slave labor workers and others. Some Italians were working there, too, that were POWs. But these slave labor camps were heinous. I cannot tell you how brutal it was. It was around the clock, often had to be were being done in underground tunnels and bunkers. The death toll was grotesque and horrific. And then von Braun got the V-2, and it started going down and hitting London.
1,400 of them, as I look back. Yeah. 1,400 of them during beginning in September of 1944, rained down on the U.S., on Great Britain, on London specifically, yeah.
London was the target. Antwerp doesn't get talked about a lot. It got hit hard by von Braun's rockets. But it could have been worse. I mean, some of those V-2s were duds because they were mass producing them so quickly. But at any rate, this was a weapon of mass destruction. But when the Germans were losing, and when Hitler commits suicide in his bunker in Berlin, von Braun had snuck out all of the blueprints and war materials, rocket parts, and with his team of Nazi scientists, engineers hid them into the mountains, and they looked to turn themselves into the United States. Yeah. In Britain, von Braun would have been charged for war crimes, and in Russia, he didn't want to go there. And under Operation Paperclip, we brought von Braun and all of the over 1,000 German scientists, rocketeers, to America. Yeah. Many were put in Fort Bliss near El Paso, then Huntsville by 1950.
So let me ask you, Douglas Brinkley, the clip from President Kennedy's Rice speech that we played a couple of minutes ago, Kennedy talks about the best of our energies, the best of our skills, that this was, a vaunted effort of that would bring out the best of the United States here. And yet a central figure to the rocket program for America was the man who helped design a weapon that rained down death on Europe. I mean, what was Kennedy's relationship with von Braun? Was he ever uncomfortable with this truth about who one of the central minds of the American burgeoning space program was?
Dwight Eisenhower was uncomfortable with von Braun, even though he had became embedded in the U.S. Army. He became an American citizen. We have to recall in the 1950s, West Germany became an ally. They would enter NATO. Konrad Adenauer was German chancellor. And so there was a feeling in America that the Germans that had relocated here weren't so bad. I raise eyebrows to this not so bad idea. I mean, von Braun and his rocketeers were in Huntsville, Alabama, a Jim Crow South, where they were being treated royally, while African Americans couldn't even go in the front door of a local blue plate diner. So I deal with the race in Alabama some in my book. But von Braun had he was an amazing opportunist, and he was very good in media. He wrote articles for Collier's magazine. He was adopted by Walt Disney, was put on television for Disney's sort of Space World of Tomorrow. He openly talked about going to the moon and Mars. And Jack Kennedy met him first in 1953 when von Braun and Kennedy were judges for Time's Man of the Year. And they chose Konrad Adenauer of West Germany. They both were debonair. They both were considered, for lack of a better term, playboys. And they got along famously well. And during his presidency, Kennedy would visit von Braun in Huntsville and Cape Canaveral. They were close because they saw themselves as 20th century men. Eisenhower, Churchill, de Gaulle, Khrushchev had been born in the 19th century. They were both born in the 20th century, jet age turned space age. And Kennedy's view was, I served in the Pacific and Solomon Islands. Von Braun was German and he had to serve Germany. That was war. We're now friends with West Germany and we're friends with Japan. And he didn't hold quite the grudge against von Braun that Eisenhower had.
Explain that a little bit more to me, because didn't quite hold the grudge, but, you know, for all the reasons that you just said, it still seems like an odd pairing, if I might say.
Well, you know, Eisenhower, with the Holocaust, he filmed the camps. He was there in Europe. He was, you know, our supreme Allied commander, and he really understood how awful the Nazis were. Not that Jack Kennedy didn't, too. But Kennedy's brother died in the war. Kennedy's brother, Joe Kennedy, died in an airplane packed with dynamite aimed at taking out missile V-1, V-2, or 3 facility along the French coast. And so missiles became the big deal. And after the war, von Braun was the coveted trophy of the war. The Soviets got rocket intelligence and we did. And as you know, today's world is one of ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles. For example, during Kennedy's presidency, the Jupiter missiles that were in Turkey that became talked about during the Cuban Missile Crisis were built by Wernher von Braun. Mm-hmm. So he had been on Time magazine's cover and all. Our country, not just Jack Kennedy, turned him into the celebrity rocketeer. And so when we're dealing with when in that clip you played earlier, you said Vanguard. Vanguard was the Navy's rocket program that Eisenhower preferred, but the Vanguard rockets blew up on the launch pads. Kennedy went with the Army, and the Army was Huntsville, and it was von Braun, and his rockets did not blow up on the launch pad. So more and more it became popular. It particularly got the big Saturn class of rockets, which
right.
brought us to the moon.
Yeah.
Atlas rockets were built by the Air Force, were more Air Force, and that was Los Angeles,
well,
San Diego.
So von Braun, just to put a fine point on it, was what, the chief architect of the Saturn V that got those three men to the moon. Let's go to Peter, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. And Peter, I understand that you actually watched the Saturn V take off when you were a kid. Is that right?
When I was a kid, yes, I'm not old enough to remember all the politics. I've learned all of that through reading historians such as your guest. But I do remember watching Saturn V rockets on a little black and white TV in my parents' house. And when the rocket would get off the pad, I'd run out in the backyard and watch it rise up over the lake that we lived on. In Central Florida, this is the same lake where I used to catch alligators and bring them home and put them in the bathtub until my mom made me put them back into the lake.
Florida and, childhood.
Yeah, and you know, unquestionably, the whole space program had a big impact on me as a kid, and I ended up going into science, and maybe not surprisingly, with the alligator story, into marine biology and then oceanography. Maybe surprisingly, considering that field, I'm now a NASA scientist at Goddard Space Flight Center.
Wow.
But of course I'm an Earth scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of folks don't, maybe your guests will reflect on this at some point, but lots of folks don't realize how much, Earth science, as well as astrophysics and planetary exploration, NASA does. The question I like to ask your guest is, while I'm very excited about a return to the moon, I'm wondering if your guests could reflect on how NASA doesn't lose sight of its mission to understand life on Earth
right.
and understand other planets
yeah.
and the galaxy.
Yeah. Peter, thank you so much for your call. Douglas Brinkley, would you like to respond to Peter?
Well, thank you for your service with NASA. Greatly appreciated. My admiration for NASA knows no bounds. And you were mentioning Florida with alligators in Louisiana, right outside of New Orleans, where they were assembling Saturn rockets. Their slogan of the NASA facility was "From Muskrats to Moonshots," because, you know, it was facilities built along these waterways in the southern zone. Look, the new moonshot might be an Earthshot. And NASA's playing a very key role. This isn't just about going to the moon. It's about our satellites and our mapping of the planet and the climate change challenge that we have right now, we need to save the planet Earth. And I am also, if possible, would like to go back to the moon. I think Mars exploration's great, but we are in the middle of a catastrophe going on right now. And the work that NASA does in earth sciences is just as important as Caltech or Jet Propulsion Laboratories' Mars work. I think that we need to appreciate and trust scientists more. The great thing about writing about Kennedy era was Kennedy's belief in the scientist. You know, scientists won Time's Man of the Year in 1960, generic scientist. But today we don't have presidential leadership on the climate issue. And it's sad. It's terrifying. And thank goodness NASA is constantly working to provide us with accurate data.
Well, Douglas Brinkley, stand by here for just a second, because I would like to welcome into the conversation Alex Stuckey. Alex joins us from Houston, NASA science and environment reporter for the Houston Chronicle. And Alex is also co-host of the Chronicle's podcast, Cigarettes and Rocket Fuel, a week-by-week dramatization of the 1969 Apollo missions and the U.S.-Soviet space race. Alex Stuckey, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. First of all, I just want to play a scene from the latest episode of Cigarettes and Rocket Fuel. By the way, a terrific name for a podcast, Alex. This is from, the latest episode, and it was published just last Thursday. Came out 50 years to the day after the death of President Eisenhower. So here's a moment from Cigarettes and Rocket Fuel.
Good afternoon, y'all, and welcome to Space Talk Sunday with Alex and Andy. The nation is grieving this Palm Sunday. We lost a great man, Dwight David Eisenhower.
That's right, Alex. Right this minute in Washington, D.C., President Eisenhower's casket is about to be placed on a caisson for a funeral procession down Constitution Avenue to the Capitol, complete with a military band and a 21-gun salute.
That's an excerpt from the podcast Cigarettes and Rocket Fuel, produced by Alex Stuckey. She's the co-host of that podcast. So, Alex, I just wanted to play that because you're doing this week-by-week dramatization of what happened in 1969. And you've heard Douglas Brinkley so far walk us through some of the political and geopolitical and even scientific motivations that President John F. Kennedy had. First of all, what do you make of this point in time of April in 1969 in terms of where we were in the effort? What have you learned?
Well, it was a busy time. At this point, we had July on the books to go to the moon. And in fact, we had July 20th on the books, which is when they actually landed. So there was still one more mission before we landed, Apollo 10. That went up in May. And at this point, there was still a little bit of a discussion of whether we would land on the moon in Apollo 10. Obviously, we know that didn't happen, right? Mm-hmm. Apollo 11 went there. But it's a really busy time. Things were going pretty smoothly. Apollo 9 had just happened. But if you talk to any of the mission controllers now, you know, they say we didn't know. We had no idea if we were going to be able to do this. We were just trying to get there before the Soviets did.
Right. So, Alex, so take us back a little bit further from 1969. And Doug Brinkley, I'm going to talk with you about this as well, because, of course, President Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, and he was the original visionary or the political drive behind this. Were there ever any moments between 63 and 69 where the American effort stumbled or may have faltered because of the lack of Kennedy at the helm driving it?
I mean, I don't think, you know, obviously we stumbled, right? We had the Apollo 1 fire in 67. And like I said, and Douglas can say this too, you know, we were really just sort of flying by the seat of our pants, not really sure. Everything we did was something we'd never done before and, you know, not really sure how well these things are going to go. But it really is, if you look back at history, really, Kennedy united everyone in a sense that even in 69, when they landed on the moon, they said, we accomplished Kennedy's goal. It sort of had that speech and his mission sort of had this unifying characteristic that stretched all the way until the moon landing.
Well, Alex Stuckey and Douglas Brinkley, stand by for just a moment. We are talking about, we're looking back at the 50th anniversary, I should say, of the 1969 moon landing with some fresh eyes. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Douglas Brinkley. He's author of American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race. Alex Stuckey also joins us. She's NASA science and environment reporter for the Houston Chronicle and co-host of the Chronicle's podcast, Cigarettes and Rocket Fuel. And we're taking a look back with fresh eyes on the 50th anniversary as it approaches of the American Moonshot. And we're also going to ask if maybe another moonshot is a worthy endeavor today. Douglas Brinkley, before we sort of focus our attention on 2019 in American space ambitions, there's one more figure in your book, your considerable book that I wanted to talk about, and that's James Webb, the NASA administrator during the Kennedy administration. How central was he to getting NASA and the rest of the country behind this project?
Webb may be an unsung hero of the NASA saga. He administered NASA during the Kennedy-Johnson years, and he was remarkable. He was from North Carolina. He was a technocrat. He understood Capitol Hill politics. He was Bobby Kennedy thought he was a blabbermouth. He would talk all the time, but he really knew how to talk up space and get the money. He was in business with Robert Kerr, an Oklahoma senator, in the oil business before he came to NASA. And Kerr was the head of the Senate Space Appropriations Committee. Lyndon Johnson's close ally in Texas was Albert Thomas, congressman from Houston. So the Webb is working very closely with Thomas and Kerr and had the politics. How do you get those $1 billion appropriations? In the mid-60s, you know, something like 4.4% of our annual federal budget went into NASA, went for the space program, and it had to be defended. William Fulbright right. was against it and almost went down by 5 Senate votes. Walter Mondale was against funding it. It hit highs and lows, and after it was just mentioned by Alex, the Apollo 1 disaster, many people thought that this was foolhardy because of the fear of dead astronauts. If we're doing this for global prestige, what if the Apollo 11 didn't work and Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins were floating around and unable to come back home to spaceship Earth? So the risks were exceedingly high. And the fact that Apollo 11 went so nearly flawless. And as Alex said, when they finally brought our astronauts back, they put task accomplished underneath John F. Kennedy's words. Nixon later lost some interest because ratings went down after Apollo 11 on other moon shots. And in the end, he canceled three Apollo programs. Saturn started becoming museum pieces. And we've never quite been able to rebottle up that the excitement of space exploration like we did in Kennedy Johnson years.
Well, so let me ask you, though, Douglas, because a couple of years ago, I went and listened to some White House recordings that the John F. Kennedy Library released of conversations between Kennedy and Webb. And I remember there's one point from a 1963 recording where Kennedy, even though he is full force, you know, trying to get America to rally around a space moonshot program, he still occasionally asks Webb, like, do you think landing a man on the moon is a good idea? Was there some uncertainty between the two of them, even as late as 1963?
Well, there was a little bit in the sense of it was eating up so much of the budget, uh-huh. and Kennedy was getting beat up on it. But that was Kennedy's way of getting a defense out of Webb. You know, are we sure? Because think about this. If at the end of the decade, Kennedy would not have been president when we landed on the moon, and it was eating up a lot of his oxygen. But listeners should know that in November of 63, the day before Kennedy was killed, he was in San Antonio, Texas, talking about the miracles of spin-off medical technology, MRIs, CAT scans, kidney dialysis. On and on, he gave a speech about space. Then in Houston, he gave a speech with Congressman Albert Thomas there about what a great payload Saturn was going to be. And then finally, when he was driving at the grassy knoll, he was carrying the speech he was giving at the trademark, which was space speech, bragging about the new frontier and Earth satellites and weather reconnaissance satellites and the moonshot. So at the time he was killed, he was about to go do oratory on NASA and space.
Okay. Well, let's shift gears here a little bit, because, I mean, we could talk for hours and hours about what you've written in your book, Doug, and the totality of the podcast that you're putting together, Alex. But, you know, we should talk about the fact that it just was last week where Vice President Mike Pence said, you know, he referenced President Kennedy saying that Kennedy knew history isn't written by those who cling to the status quo, but rather is written by those who dare to dream big and to do the impossible. And then Vice President Pence compared Kennedy, the 35th president, to the current president, the 45th, Donald Trump.
Now, as then, the United States has a president who's a dreamer, who understands that this is a challenge that, once again, we are unwilling to postpone, and one which we intend to win again. President Trump knows that meeting this challenge will require a great national investment of time, talent, and resources. But the costs of inaction are greater.
That's Vice President Mike Pence in Huntsville, Alabama, just last week. So, Alex Duckey, you know, the United States went to the moon in the course of a decade in the 1960s. The vice president now is saying we ought to return to the moon in roughly half that time. Ostensibly, it's a very possible goal. But do we have a space program currently set up to achieve that goal? And was it a surprise to folks at NASA to hear the vice president say this?
I mean, I think, you know, it was a surprise in the sense that, you know, 2 weeks before this speech that you're referencing, the Trump administration handed down a budget request that slashed $500 million from NASA's budget. And, you know, that speech is great, but there's not any money to back it up right now. And I think, you know, Douglas referenced this earlier, but, you know, they had like 5% of the budget mm-hmm. in the 1960s. And now they have 0.4%, I think it is. So is it possible for the U.S. to get back to the moon by 2024? Theoretically, yes, but we're going to need more money to do that. And there hasn't been any budget
request, you know, or amendment submitted to Congress. In fact, NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine was speaking to Congress this morning and said, we're working on a budget amendment for you guys. So there's really nothing to back this up right now.
Right. Well, so Douglas Brinkley, then in addition, there's the question of what is to be gained, right? Because we've got some commenters here on Twitter. Brando Flex is saying, after 50 years, we should have 10,000 people living and working on the moon. Instead, we need another country to fly our astronauts to the space station. And Sandra says, what do we learn by going back again? Yeah, we did it once. And? Question mark. So what is to potentially be gained by a return to the moon?
Well, for Donald Trump and Vice President Pence, possibly winning Florida is at stake, having the rhetoric of going to the moon. Central Florida coast, Jacksonville down to Vero Beach, it's a technology corridor. It's crucial for Donald Trump's electoral hopes in 2020. So talking about going back to the moon, meaning in the next couple of years, we're going to be funding this more, even though you're slashing the budget now. Pretty good politics if you're looking at Florida. And Pence is from Indiana. Purdue University is an epicenter for space exploration. That's where Neil Armstrong went to college and majored in engineering, and Gus Grissom and so many of our astronauts. Space is big in Indiana also. So, but many presidents say that we're going to go to Mars and the moon, and it never happens because they don't prioritize it. What's important about what Jack Kennedy did is he gave it the funding. You got to go and make it a bipartisan effort. You have to sell it to the American people. And now we have private sector companies. I won't name them all due to time, but like Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin or projects by Musk and Branson that are trying to do space exploration. The Trump administration may try to broker a deal between the NASA and some of these companies to try to go back to the moon in a federal government private sector partnership.
Mm. Well, Alex Stuckey, we've got a comment here from our website from Fun Girl, who says, why is walking on the moon a, quote, great accomplishment? In hindsight, it looks like a costly boondoggle with little or no benefit to humanity. The money and talent could have been spent in better ways. Is that a criticism that still dogs NASA to this day?
I don't think so. Really, I think the criticism now is, you know, why would we go back like you guys were just talking about? And NASA's response to that is, you know, we now know there's water on the moon, or there's ice on the moon. So that could, you know, be used to create life support and used to create rocket fuel. And that could help us get to Mars. You know, not to mention, let's be real, the scientific instruments they had in the 60s are nothing like we have now. Right. I mean, we'd be able to learn much more about it now than we ever could in the 60s. You know, but I think what no one's really talking about is, you know, we're really talking about going back to the moon because other countries are now going to the moon.
That's right.
And it's, you know, geopolitically, we need to be there if other countries are there, just like we're in Antarctica because other countries are in Antarctica. And yes, there's great science. We're learning from that. But we need to be there for geopolitical reasons.
So, I mean, Douglas Brinkley, how much then has changed since 1961, 62, and 63?
Well, Alex is exactly right. I mean, in order to really go back to the moon, you need a rival. You're going to have something to spur it forward. And it might be China. It might be that there's a new space race to China to go back to the moon. There are people that want to set up a colony on the moon to use as a springboard, if you'd like, for Mars exploration. There are many more experiments to be conducted on the moon. We were shocked when we collected all that, you know, moon rock and lunar dust to see how close the environment of the moon was to Earth. There's a huge scientific debate going on what is the moon? Was it once part of Earth? Was it about another planet colliding with Earth and it broke off? So we could learn a lot about our own planet by returning to the moon and doing proper scientific studies. And also, we did learn about Earth. Many of the astronauts I interviewed, I did the oral history for NASA of Neil Armstrong with the late historian Steve Ambrose. Armstrong didn't think this way, but many of the others I interviewed over the years have said they thought they were going to the moon, but what it was seeing Earth there. Mm-hmm. And it spurred an environmental movement in the late 60s. Bill Anders and the famous, you know, Earthrise photograph, and people start thinking about our planet in new ways. And as one of our callers talked about Earth Sciences and NASA, so I think whether we go to the moon or not, what's important is our country treasure things like NASA or the National Park Service. These are loved agencies that budgets are just getting killed right now. And they shouldn't be, because we need to be promoting science, space exploration, and Earth stewardship.
Well, to Alex's point about why the Trump administration may be looking to the moon now because other nations are, I mean, here's a quote. This is important for political reasons, international political reasons. This is, whether we like it or not, in a sense, a race. If we get second to the moon, it's nice, but it's like being second anytime. That is John F. Kennedy on November 21st, 1962. Well, let's go to Frank. Sneak one last call in here. Frank is calling from Goldsboro, North Carolina. Frank, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, for my family at that time, it was the best of times and the worst of times. We had the civil rights movement going on, the Vietnam War. I had two brothers serving Vietnam. But on that particular day, I was with three generations, my father, my brothers, and my grandfather. And I recall my father was a techno geek, so he absolutely relished in the moon landing. But my grandfather said something that sticks with me today. He was born in 1898. He said that that they really didn't land on the moon, that they're somewhere behind Africa, he said. So we all just looked at them. But I think that, you know, private industry should take the leadership today in space exploration, because mm-hmm. I think they have the most to gain, but they also have the most to teach.
Yeah. Well, Frank, thank you so much for your call. Alex and Douglas, we only got about 2 minutes left here, but I'll first turn to you, Alex. I mean, Frank's point about the private sector taking the lead, as we were all talking about, that is actually largely what is happening regarding sort of the big next steps in American space exploration, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the thing with the private sector is they can build things faster and cheaper than the government. And they're going to play an increasingly large role, especially as you look at, you know, NASA's heavy lift rocket, the Space Launch System, that can't, I mean, they cannot get it done. They just, it's been delayed and delayed and delayed, and therefore that's delaying our exploration plans. So, you know, we're already seeing a lot of commercial involvement, and I think that's only going to increase as they sort of go past us in developing things.
Yeah. And Douglas Brinkley, we've got a minute left here. Whether it's the private sector or public-private partnerships with NASA, can any big moonshot or even Mars shot happen without the political vision and weight of a leader like a President Kennedy?
It demands presidential leadership. And I'm grateful that I'm able to talk about this. I was in Ohio when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. I was a little boy. It changed my life, the idea of a lunar voyage. And we have to remember, we often talk about Pearl Harbor and Kennedy assassination and 9/11. Those are tragedies that we remember. But going to the moon was an American triumph. And it was because of about 400,000 people that worked, the contractors and the engineers of America, who are often underlooked in history. Apollo was an example of American excellence.
Well, Douglas Brinkley's new book is American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race. Doug Brinkley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Alex Stuckey, NASA science and environment reporter for the Houston Chronicle and co-host of the podcast Cigarettes and Rocket Fuel. Alex, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.